Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Suzanne Newcomb, who is a lecturer in religious studies at the Open University and honorary director of INFORM. We're speaking with her about her fascinating look at yoga in Britain on our book called Yoga in Britain. Suzanne, welcome to the program.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Your book, tell us about how you got into studying. There's lots of interesting content in your book, but tell us about how the project started up for you.
Oh, gosh. It started an embarrassingly long time ago. Probably I started looking at this in about 2002, and there really wasn't a lot of literature on contemporary yoga way back then. There's been such an amazing explosion more recently. And My basic question was a pretty naive one in a way of how and why did something ostensibly Indian called yoga become so normal? How on earth did that happen? And I had done some training in sociology of religion, but wanted to, because it was a how did this become popular question, I wanted to do it in a historical context. And I also wanted it to be local. I thought about doing it in a wider context, like the United States or Europe, but both of those quickly spiraled out of control. And Britain, and more specifically England, most of the information I got was England is nice and small and a really rich source of data. So I really, really enjoyed getting my teeth into why yoga is something that normal middle-class people do, why people, like walking into people in the streets and saying you're studying yoga, sometimes they say, oh, I'm really sorry, I haven't gone to a yoga class recently. And it feels a bit funny, like, why should I think you should have? But even that bigger question of how did they come to that, have that conversation anyway, I found really curious and fascinating.
It's certainly a fascinating phenomenon. Now, given that you're looking at yoga in a particular context, I think you make a really good point at the outset of your study, talking about almost the necessity of looking at yoga in a particular context. Can you talk to us about the various yogas or the idea of yoga being something essential and true that we can participate in versus it being something very context dependent? Could you say a bit about that in terms of your study?
Well, I guess when I first started, I was quite preoccupied, as people often do when they start a PhD, of what exactly you're studying and how are you going to delineate the subject. And I decided to take a fairly broad reportive definition of anyone who says they're doing yoga, I'll look at. But then as soon as I started doing oral history interviews and getting into particular contexts, it seems like everyone I interviewed, and I interviewed quite a lot of people, had a line somewhere in the interview that was kind of, everyone misunderstands yoga, except for me. Let me tell you what yoga really is. And I found that kind of rhetorical move fascinating. On the one hand, people are really preoccupied with having authentic, true yoga. On the other hand, it seems like what people are doing is actually very much specific to their teachers, to their contexts. And I think there's other sources of authenticity that are actually more important to contemporary practitioners than this narrative of original true yoga story. And I was also quite, kind of the gap between doing the research and actually getting around to publishing the book, quite a lot of material came out about yoga in America, because America, North America, is such a big context, so economy, and a lot was about yoga in the neoliberal context, and as a kind of, is this just people making money on a spiritual tradition and selling out? And what I was uncovering in my British research was actually there's a very different social context involved that wasn't neoliberal in its origin, even if there's a kind of neoliberal gloss on the contemporary yoga scene, just as there is in many places around the globe.
So that itself is a fascinating point. Tell us a bit about what your research shows about the different contexts, sort of the North, the American soil versus the British soil, where yoga takes root.
Well, in Britain, there were lots of different entry points at different times, and lots of individuals from colonial India and then independent India who came to Britain and wanted to promote yoga, to promote their teachings of what they thought would make a spiritually better place. So some of the contemporary issues around cultural appropriation are coming from a very different place in Britain, and this isn't really a focus of many discussions in the contemporary yoga scene in Britain, partially because so much of the yoga in its initial wave of popularity was directly from Indians who kind of said, come and do this. It's something that's really good to do. And then there were also obviously quite a few British people of various backgrounds, often upper middle class, kind of more privileged sectors of society, but who also did kind of authentic searching for something and felt that they were really presenting something that had value for people's meaning and purpose and health and physical well-being.
So a question I wanted to ask earlier was, we talked about sort of the way or you're looking at yoga in a particular cultural context. What about the when? What time period are you focusing on?
So the book has a broad time period of kind of the 20th century into the beginning of the 21st century, kind of into the present. But most of my research really concentrates between the post-war period, so 1945 to about 1980, so just before Margaret Thatcher started making the neoliberal economic reforms, which really changed the fabric of how yoga was accessed by people in Britain.
And so what data are you looking at? What are you looking at in terms of your data for that period of time?
There's a surprisingly rich amount of data. There's a lot of newspaper reports, and that's become more accessible through digitization in the last few years. There's also quite a lot of people still around who were teaching yoga in the 60s and 70s, and so I was able to capture some of that information. I also relied a lot on archives of publishing houses who were publishing information about Eastern religions or Oriental religions, they were sometimes called. In particular, I found the archives of Penguin, Ellen and Unwin. Those two were particularly rich in their detail of who was getting published and why, and the networks of people who were involved in making decisions about what got published and why. It was quite a small closed group, in fact.
So then in terms of, I guess that material is in your first chapter, The Literary Elite. So who was getting published and why?
Well, to begin with, it was largely Theosophical Society influence publications. And I think that one of the a lot of people know the Theosophical Society is this kind of esoteric, odd organization founded by a Russian woman that had lots of scandals about letters from ascended masters. And then there's the other side of the society in India, where they did a lot to promote independence and national pride. But in Britain, it really seemed to function like a place for people who were interested in alternative understandings of religion and spirituality generally to meet and explore these ideas. And although there were very well-documented schisms between different groups within the society, should they go with Eastern esotericism or Western esotericism, and I think there were quite often personality conflicts, they also had a bookshop, a distribution network, and reading rooms where people could come in and pick things off the shelf. They were very much overlapping with spiritualism at the time. Could you contact the spirits of dead people, particularly after World War One? It kind of gained popular in America after the Civil War, and in Britain it got extremely popular after World War One with the death of so many people. But also they're networked with the Society of Psychical Research, with a lot of Western magical people who were interested in esoteric traditions and ritual magic. And these people kind of took out adverts in each other's journals, and you might come across all sorts of ideas there. So the people who were going there weren't cranks. They were really interested in reassessing the Christian church and institutional religiosity. They're often quite well-established, educated people who were kind of saying, for the first time, I have access to all these different teachings of across the world. What is the truth for me? So a kind of a seekership like you saw in the 1970s, but in a very elite, a much more elite urban context.
And in addition to the circle of literature, what else do you look at during your study?
Let's see. There was lots of great little stories that came up. I was fascinated by a few people in particular. Some of the stories I'd love to get in more that I just didn't have space in this book, and maybe I'll come back to them in a later project. One of the people, that I guess the next chapter going through chronologically, is about a man called Wilfred Clark, who wound up setting up the British Wheel of Yoga. And this was a fascinating, very, very British thing. Again, before the internet, how did people network? And how did they find out about something called yoga? Wilfred Clark he served in the First World War, and he said that his first experience of yoga, or his first mention of yoga, was from some Indian servicemen who were serving alongside of him, who quoted the Bhagavad Gita in trying to inspire fortitude in the face of battle. And he thought, oh, this is interesting. And so then he came back to Britain and was into amateur dramatics, and took a correspondence course on Oriental philosophy from the Oxford Correspondence Centre. So that's kind of adult education before some of the first adult education. And there's starting to be books published on yoga in this kind of interwar period. And he at some point got a caravan in the back of his backyard in Birmingham, and started, he worked in local newspapers, and he started putting out adverts in local newspapers saying, like, are you interested in yoga? Write to me. And then he'd have a little card filing system, and he'd put all the people in the same geographical area in touch with each other. And then he started sending out bulletins, which he typed out on carbon copy paper to these people. And through these networks, it was first the Wheel of British Yoga, and then eventually the British Wheel of Yoga. He encouraged people to start teaching each other and then putting themselves forward to teach others. And he kind of developed his own vision of what yoga was, which was inclusive and in some ways very non-dogmatic, but in other ways quite dogmatic in that it must include philosophy, it must include meditation, it must include relaxation and a little bit of asana, but it's primarily philosophy. And by philosophy, he was primarily drawing on Vivekananda's explanations of bhakti, raja, jhana, and hatha yoga, and probably in with hatha yoga, certainly at the lowest end of esteem. He was amazingly successful at this networking and in defining a kind of a British interpretation of yoga. And in the 1960s, when more gurus started to come to Britain more frequently, he had a very much anti-guru position in that you should take teachings from everyone, but not affiliate yourself to any one person. And too much devotion to one figure is unhealthy.
So it's interesting then, even in these early days, that his vision of yoga was more similar to something including all eight of the limbs rather than just postures. So what happened later with the charismatic gurus?
Gosh, all sorts of things happened. There were several people who tried to set themselves up as charismatic gurus before the 1960s. And in a way, one of the things I found interesting was the 1960s started kind of maybe with the Beatles discovering the Maharishi in 1968, I believe. But it started much later than the kind of big explosion in young people's popular interest was really 69, 70, early 70s. And I had expected it to be earlier. But what you had in the early 60s was a lot of middle-class women going to do yoga as adult education. So there was already a kind of a thousands of middle-class British women were already doing yoga before alternative gurus started showing up.
And what were, just a quick footnote, what were those women interested in, do you find?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think they were interested in, I think that the yoga classes that they accessed, which were often in physical education departments, despite the British Wheel of Yoga's disapproval of this, one of the most interesting figures, which I was really excited to uncover in my research, was this woman called Yogini Sunita, who was born Bernadette Cabral as a very anglicized Indian in a Bombay suburb with English as her first language. She wore Western suits when she worked at the Italian embassy in Bombay. But then she moved to Birmingham just before immigration changes made it harder for Indians to resettle in Britain. And once she was in Birmingham, she found that people weren't too interested in an Indian piano teacher, but they were very interested in an Indian yoga teacher. So she put her hair up in a bun, she started wearing saris and introducing herself as Yogini Sunita. And she was getting hundreds of students in the Birmingham Athletics Institute and teaching, there's a few, her children are still safeguarding her legacy. And there's a few people still teaching it, but it's a different form than you would see today. There's a lot of Padmasana, a kind of a flowing posture. And her signature teaching was the slip second. So if you can just forget all your worries and have complete peace for 1 second, that's worth more than 6 hours of sleep. And this is where the attraction to women come in. So she was kind of setting herself up as almost the superwoman of, she had three children, but she had time for everything. And she had time to help everyone de-stress. She said something about, a true yogi should not have a wrinkle on their brow. So it's almost about an attitude to life. And then if you look at her teacher training, she had one teacher training session before she kind of tragically died in her early 30s, about 1970. I might have the date a little bit wrong. But a lot of the women, you can see there was a great camaraderie between the women. They came to the classes to get out of the house. That might have been their break from childcare and child work. And increasingly, as women found employment in adult education teaching yoga. It was a kind of useful second income that gave a woman some pocket money. And this was before women were in the workplace very much at all. So it was fairly elitist in that the primary target audience was housewives, but it also offered housewives a real chance to have autonomy over their bodies, to explore what was going on for them, to relax, to forge new social connections. And the autonomy over their bodies also became important in how it intersected with second wave feminism and reforms to childbirth movements, which yoga was a big part of in the 1970s.
So what other charismatic teachers do you look at?
Well, before we get into the kind of guru scene of the 1960s, which is really a lot of fun, BKS Iyengar was a huge influence in Britain. And one of the arguments I tried to make in the book was that it was actually getting into the adult education service in Britain, which secularized and standardized his teaching into this format of syllabuses and distance training programs so that it could be exported globally in a standardized, recognizable way. And he came into Britain on the back of Yehudi Menuhin, who is a world famous violinist, and he got some early publicity in the BBC. He kind of was into the upper class networks that Menuhin provided him access with. And through these connections, he was introduced to a chap called Gerald York, who was able to help him get Light on Yoga published and helped him revise it and bring up the standard of English. And he also, through Menuhin's sister, was introduced to the head of the PE department in the Inner London Education Authority, a man called Peter McIntosh. And Peter McIntosh had a Grecian ideal of physical culture, where he felt that physical culture was really spiritual in its essence and necessary for a well-rounded human being. So although he was quite strict, and the education authority kind of contract with Iyengar said that only teachers, only gurus approved of by Iyengar are allowed to teach in London on public funds, we don't want any language relating to spirituality and only direct instruction on asana and pranayama. So that did not come from Iyengar. And in fact, his earlier presentations involved extensive quotes from the Bhagavad Gita in the kind of newspaper write-ups. So the shape and the kind of global product of Iyengar yoga, I would argue, was actually really shaped by the needs of the adult education system in London and the ideology of this chap, Peter McIntosh, who saw physical culture as more than just physical. And Iyengar was willing to take this on in his correspondence about it, was because he thought a better life, more ethical behavior, and essentially the principles of yoga can be taught without mentioning the religious words. So there's a kind of, you don't have to have lots of talk about God to actually help people find their own way to a more spiritual life.
So how would you say this is continuity or divergence from what was going on with the wheel of British yoga?
Well, there was quite a lot of conflict and quite a lot of jealousy in terms of the British wheel was really unhappy to be shut out of the London teaching venues, and also vehemently was ideologically opposed to the focus on asana. They thought that was perverting yoga in much of the same arguments you see. And also there was a lot of discussion at the time about the perhaps violent methods Iyengar was using. He was compared to a drill sergeant. It was openly discussed that he hit students at times, and the people who appreciated Iyengar's teaching. It felt this was in line with maybe the kind of old school PE teaching they had in school or military drills, and felt that it woke them up. But for people who, other people found this completely anti-ahimsa, anti the higher principles of ethical behavior, and that he was just a contortionist show-off. So all these debates were happening in the 1970s in Britain. And the camps sometimes were quite antagonistic to each other. So you won't see many Iyengar teachers participating in the bulletin of the British Wheel of Yoga, which had a lot of published every month throughout the late 60s and 70s. And they more slowly developed their own networks and publications, the Iyengar movement did. But the Iyengar movement always had a foothold on the physical education side. So if people were looking for precise physical discipline, they would go to an Iyengar class. And there was actually, in practice, quite a lot of crossover in that people would drop in and take and improve their asana and then go do with it what they wanted. And on the individual level, I think there was actually quite a lot of discussion. So there was both animosity and integration in the opposing camps.
And so in your chapter, I think it's chapter 4, where you discuss the middle class women who join evening classes, these women sort of start off, as you say, looking for a distraction or looking for health benefits. Can you talk about whether or not they were looking for or ended up getting more than that? Like, was there a spiritual dimension to these classes as well?
I think it's a bit hard to say in any, I mean, certainly, and it depends on what you mean by spirituality. Certainly some women started off with an idea that it was spiritual. Other women, or other practitioners, I think there's no reason to gender it particularly, had a very clear religious identity of their own, and they didn't necessarily feel like attending an asana-based class threatened their own pre-existing affiliation. And then the question is do people cross over time? And in one of the first bit of research I did on yoga was actually a big survey of Iyengar practitioners in 2001. And that suggested actually there wasn't, people kind of started off with largely a spiritual intention or physical intention in that particular, because of course Iyengar yoga is a very ostensibly physically oriented practice, although it's changed since the 1970s quite a lot and is incorporating more overtly spiritual elements now than it did then. But I think what's actually interesting is the most popular teachers were always bringing in life lessons and ethical reflections and perhaps aspects of the yamas and niyamas into their asana teaching. So while so it's kind of like what is the violence between the unevenness in your right and left sides, or as you extend. One of the teachers who did a lot to popularize yoga in London was a woman called Penny Neal Smith, and her students, she had died before I did this, but her students really fondly remembered her passion for social justice and anti-racism, and remember her often bringing in reflections on contemporary social movements into the subtext of the asana instruction. And so are those kind of reflections, is trying to live your life more morally and ethically, with having maybe an agnostic approach to God. I think that's very common in Britain. Is that spiritual? I guess it depends on what you think is the where people should have their attention.
There seems to be this there's a running theme of attention, probably to this very day, of yoga as physical postures primarily or exclusively versus yoga as grounded in a particular religiosity or a path towards human virtues, something much more subtle than physical health benefits. And so this tension seems to have been there. If I'm understanding correctly, I mean, throughout the period you're studying from 45 to 1980, would you say that's
the
case?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or would you say it morphs or there's a pendulous sway? Sorry, say that again. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, absolutely. The tension is there throughout. And even in the earlier physical culture journals, where yoga was also popularized in the 20s and 30s, which Mark Singleton's done a bit more work on. So there was definitely this tension, but I think also what gets forgotten was there's actually a really deep Western, if we have to use those kind of words, tradition of physicality as a spiritual endeavor and using the body as a tool for more meaningful ends. So I think that part of the... For a lot of people working with their bodies in a serious way, in a serious discipline, it's more than just physical. And I think we tend to forget about that when we look at this. Is it spiritual? Is it physical? It's a lot more complex. People's embodied experiences is more complex than that.
So after your chapter on women and their experience of yoga, you have a chapter on popular music in the counterculture in the 60s and 70s. Do you want to say a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's just so much fun. And it
totally.
It was really fun to research and explore. I mean, one of the things I think it is important to realize how much came before. And in many ways, this was the icing on the cake. But everything really exploded, and really so many of the big names touched on things to do with yoga and the Maharishi. And what was really one of the more fun things to come across were these people I could interview. So particularly Muz Murray, who operated Gandalf's Garden. So Gandalf's Garden was like the classic happening. And it actually springbacked over a previous house happening called Center House, which also incorporated a lot of yoga and macrobiotics and experimental lifestyles. But Gandalf's Garden was just fantastic because it has this amazing psychedelic artwork, which incorporates the ideology of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, this kind of a poetic exploration, and Muz Murray is still around, still teaching mantra meditation, and has a really, really good memory of his crazy life. But to quote a little bit about their gatherings, they say, soul gardeners and seekers of the miraculous get together for vibration raising study, discussion, Chinese tea, and soul stimulation. Sessions begin with mantra meditation, no problem for beginners who can just sit and absorb the vibes to rarefy the atmosphere. Then follows reflections on the eternal why of our existence from any angel open to us, initiated by the gardeners or by visiting yogis, occultists, healers, mediums, monks, astrologers, writers, researchers, or other groups well into their own thing who have offered to come along and be a catalytic element for discussion. He was really clocked into the huge music scene, and he had the well-known DJ John Peel write, and he had benefit concerts where people like some of the big names. This is where I got stuck before. Some of the big names came. Mark Bolan, that's what it was, and David Bowie. Both did benefits for Gandalf's Garden, and he tried to have it as an alternative to the drug scene, like 3HO also did, and 3HO came at this time, and the early Shivananda Center in London was also very much part of this experimental happening, and people who had been traveling, who were interested in all sorts of of thinking outside the box. And Gandalf's Garden has a fantastic issue on trepanning, where you drill a hole in your head and how this compares to headstand. It's just such fun to read about. But what was also interesting is how Muzz Murray, his idiosyncratic spiritual vision came about on his travels through Africa and spiritual experiences he had there, which actually goes back to Gerald York had similar experiences, as well as Aleister Crowley. And there's a whole, people were doing the hippie trail, having the hippie travel experiences for the whole of the 20th century. And this kind of all came together in a unique time in the early 70s, where people really tried to live in an alternative, non-commercial way. And Gandalf's Garden always was operating on a shoestring as this drop-in center on the King's Road in Chelsea, which is a very posh place that is incredibly expensive to even get a toehold in today. And he distributed magazines throughout Europe, which would help popularize the movement and the art and just the kind of coolness of it all. But they never set up a way to ensure they had enough money to keep going. And people were likely to get sidetracked in selling the magazines for buying and more immediately entertaining needs that they might have had, and so it unfortunately didn't last that long, just because the structures, the social and financial structures to keep it going in such an expansive free form vision weren't there. And a lot of the connections and organizations did maintain themselves and slowly transformed into things more stable. So with the Shivananda Center, which was very much two women who had about a year's experience of Shivananda yoga in Canada, came and kind of sent up the first Shivananda Center in the house, which was kind of communally shared. And much more, the gender balance in the hippie scene here was much more balanced than in the adult education scene, where it was much more women, and this was much more of a mixed bag. But the Shivananda people who set up the original center got a bit discouraged when more central control came in from the Shivananda organization that already had an established network of centers internationally. And they moved on with their guru, the original people, and a very different Shivananda organization appeared. And Shivananda yoga, interestingly, has been much less influential in Britain than in Germany. And in many other places in the English-speaking world, partially because of these influences in the publishing houses. And it wasn't, Shivananda didn't actually get his books were published, were distributed in Britain, but he didn't get a British publisher or promotion network, partially because of the judgment of Gerald York, who advised a lot of the publishing houses on what to publish and what not to publish. And in his view, the yoga promoted by Shivananda was much less coherent than that, say, offered by Iyengar or some of the other teachers at the time.
So why was the yoga offered by Shivananda? Can you tell us a bit about that distinction between Iyengar and Shivananda?
Shivananda tried to bring much more bhakti yoga, devotion, and much more selfless service. And so the early, they did teach asanas and pranayama, but there was this sense of it was a lifestyle and everyone should help out in the center, and coming from this kind of hippie communal spirit. And an idea that kind of any true engagement with yoga really means all these aspects of their life. The Shivananda centers was less kind of goal oriented. It was more exploratory. The teachers would follow, there wasn't a direct framework for how do you teach asana, how do you know if an asana is good or bad. it was more like a lot of the British Wheel of Yoga. You read instructions for a book and much more breath oriented. So inhale, arch up, exhale, go back and inhale, twist to the left. So they didn't want people to strain. They weren't striving for perfection in any posture, but it was more about relaxing, being kind, joining in, thinking about the spiritual was a very much an important part of the Shivananda context, in a way that it was kind of pushed to the side in mainstream Iyengar classes.
Why don't you tell us a bit about yoga as therapy?
So that's a theme that reoccurs throughout the history of yoga in the 20th century. And it obviously comes from some of the physical culture remedial exercises, which have origins in Ling's Swedish gymnastics, which may or may not have connections with Taoist exercises. And there's a whole body of literature on that in the background. But in Britain, yoga was always presented as a cure for modern ills. And in the earlier 20th century, there was an interesting chap called Desmond Dunn who really was one of the first maybe to market it as relaxation for the stresses of modern life. And he did a very interesting survey just after the Second World War about, do people know what yoga is? No, but my yogism can help them with their stress and strains. But also, the breathing, being more fit is good for health as well, but also a lot of these movements that we're seeing a resurgence of now, so yoga for disabled people, yoga for specific injuries, a lot of people who were converts to Iyengar's methods had serious injuries that they felt were addressed and improved by Iyengar yoga or by Iyengar's personal interventions when medical doctors had given up on them. And I think this is a theme that comes up again and again, not just with yoga in Britain, but also some of my more recent work on Ayurveda in India, was that there's a whole host of ills of the body and mind that are chronic and debilitating that people experience a shift of when they do some of these practices. And that feel-good change keeps them coming back and is kind of a kind of embodied conversion experience to the practice, if not an ideology. But at the same time, yoga in as therapy has had to walk a very fine line in not making medical claims, in not necessarily presenting itself as a cure for any specific condition. And as we're getting more regulation in therapy yoga, this kind of goes back to a long history of how do we regulate yoga teachers, what's a good use of public funds, what should insurance pay for, but also how do you make sure that people don't get hurt? And these aren't new discussions at all. These are things that were being discussed in the 70s. And Iyengar's approach was seen as a kind of having a minimum standard of safety to it, which some local education authority officials felt was more reliable than the teaching of some of the British Wheel, which had maybe less attention to the detail of postures or didn't necessarily prohibit people with certain conditions from doing, say, a headstand or something. So yoga as therapy has both been an inherent part of its appeal and why people do it, but it's also been, like so many other things in this area, quite ambivalent in terms of how it presents itself. And it's got to be quite careful to not overstep into the bounds of medical professionals, which are very very powerful in terms of what is appropriate to say is a cure or a solution for a problem.
So perhaps this is a good opportunity to talk about what you talk about in your eighth chapter in terms of the diversity of practice and practitioners of yoga.
Yeah, so I think that that kind of comes back to where I started in how I interviewed so many people who said no one really understands what yoga means, but let me explain it to you. And I think there has been a lot of kind of seekership in the attitude of people who have explored yogic practices or identified and taught yoga, identified with and taught yoga over the years. And I think it's quite easy to, for a lot of people, and hopefully my book and a lot of the other scholarship that's coming out now is helps contribute to an understanding of the diversity of different ways people use and apply the concepts and techniques of yoga. And it's not just a kind of superficial pick and mix spirituality, but there's a lot of different ways of engaging with these ideas and practices for personal transformation. And it's kind of like with so many other religious traditions, it's kind of an invitation, knowing someone's committed to something in some way is an invitation to find out more rather than assume that you know what their yoga, what their understanding of yoga is.
Would you say this diversification of which you speak is a function of yoga in this 20th century British context? Or would you say there's a certain diversification of yoga that's a function of just the various ways in which these practices have indigenously been engaged?
I think this is more, there's a specific way that people in Britain have been presented yoga and how they've engaged with those concepts. But I think that this is more pervasive in the Indian traditions and the way that the Indian traditions engage with finding God and practices and techniques in which one can connect with the world greater than one's small self. And you see this great diversity of practices when you look at yoga in 20th century India and how it transforms from something associated with specific ascetic communities and maybe more extreme practices to encompassing the physical culture, nationalistic healthy body movement. But even today, people are very willing to draw upon in a very generous way the techniques and practices and understandings which facilitate their experiencing the divine in however they understand it. And so I think that there's something broader about the techniques of yoga and that way of engaging with the more than mundane world of our daily concerns, which maybe reflects something that's more pervasive about the Indian traditions of religiosity than just the specific way the British public has engaged with it, which is also very specific and about their own unique history and the structures which popularized it and the social context which enabled people to access these ideas.
So there's obviously a wealth of material in your study of yoga in Britain during this period. How do you bring it all together? What do you overarchingly find or argue in your study?
I think that it's really to highlight how complex and multi-layered yoga is, and that authority for these traditions and the history of these traditions is much more rich and interculturally conceptually layered. The idea that there is a single authentic way of transmission or lineage of transmission is becoming complicated by a lot of scholars' work. But understanding in going in depth into one specific location where it was popularized, where there were these diversities of engagement, of understanding, can help you, the reader, think about if you're an academic, what criteria you want to use, how does this engage with your research interests. But if you're a practitioner or just someone who's interested in yoga and popular culture, it's about thinking more clearly about what criteria you want to use for an authentic practice. And it can't just be an imagined historical tradition. It has to be based on criteria, I believe, more on what's happening here and now, and on what people are doing in the practices, how is it affecting their behavior, their treatment of other people, their understandings, how are they drawing on their own experience in a helpful and mature way. But that's more my personal evaluation at the end of all my study on this subject about what might be a more authentic practice than others. And I don't think that you necessarily need to come to the same conclusions as me, but if you can just realize that it is so multi-layered, and the intercultural intercultural kind of marriages of ideas is really complex, and what yoga is today is not the result of a transplantation of an Indian tradition or the appropriation of an Indian tradition, but it was kind of co-created between lots of different cultures and people, often very proactively of Indian origin, but also the understandings and the variety of ways that people chose to engage in specific aspects of that, of the wider yoga traditions.
It seems then that that your findings challenge it's sort of a difficult to take a sort of essentialist or fundamentalist attitude to what yoga is, based on your examination of yoga in one nation over these past few decades. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings me on, if I can push my next edited book.
You'll save me the trouble of asking you about it. So please go ahead.
So one of the outputs of this very specific study is an edited book that will come out, The Handbook of Yoga and Meditation, that will come out hopefully later this year, maybe early next year, co-edited with Karen O'Brien Kopp, who's at Roehampton, and she was previously at SOAS. But one of the things we really want to explore in that book is just how complex these overlaps and different locations are. And obviously we do a limited job, because you can only do so much in one book, but how did yoga and meditation studies, at least in the academy, they're often kind of these siloed areas of expertise, but actually the practices and the words even overlap a lot. So trying to kind of break through that multi-layered complexity, but also to look at, we've got chapters on yoga and meditation practices in Korea and Latin America and Japan, which all have very unique understandings and interpretations. We look at these practices from a variety of doctrinal perspectives, and also one of the things I'm most personally fascinated in is the perspective of academic disciplines. And so I come from this sociologically informed historical perspective primarily. But if you're coming from a philological perspective, or a critical theory perspective, or a digital humanities perspective,
ethics,
your questions are different, and what you see is different. And so, what yoga or ethics, yeah, what you see is completely different. So, what yoga and meditation are actually different depending on what questions you're interested in, and what you're bringing to the subject.
So, when might this volume be out?
Over the manuscript to Routledge, so we'll have to see if it's delayed, but hopefully in the next year, we're hoping.
Well, then you'll have to come back on the program, either you or your co-editor or both can come back on the program and share your findings in that. I imagine there are a great many people.
Yeah, we'd love to. Thanks.
Yes, I imagine there are a great many folks in the audience who may have a relationship to yoga, whether as an object of study or personal practice, and I'm sure this podcast has helped them to understand the complexity of this thing we call yoga in the West. Was there anything else in the book or in your research that you would have liked us to touch upon?
I didn't talk very much about the Beatles, but that's been covered so many other places.
So then why that, you know,
but they're really good fun.
I don't think you can get enough of the Beatles. So tell us about the Beatles in your book.
Well, the Beatles were, of course, incredibly influential in popularizing all sorts of Eastern spirituality, because nothing had ever been as popular as the Beatles. And so when they started using sitars and when they went to see the Maharishi in Rishikesh, this really opened things out to a much wider audience. But what I actually found more interesting were the kind of more detailed connections. So B.K.S. Iyengar's sponsor, Yehudi Menuhin, he actually was really interested in music, obviously, and he had this Asian music circle with another man, the Agandes, and they collected together musicians like Jacqueline Dupree, who was a world famous cellist at the time, and really helped promote Ravi Shankar and Indian dance in London, and kind of bring in the highest of Indian culture to things like the South Bank Centre, the best venues in London. This started in the early 60s, this kind of intercultural musical exchange, and it was kind of foreshadowed by jazz musicians' exploration of world music to try to get away from the more oppressive Western traditions. And so it was Menuhin's sponsorship and help as well that brought over Ravi Shankar, the sitar player, and George Harrison actually met him at the house of the Agandes, which is where Iyengar was teaching his asana classes for some time. And the connections between music and dance were much more local. And then the story about how George Harrison got involved with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and kind of the there's just some great stories about how he engaged with them. It felt like a homecoming. And the promotion of a really inclusive vision of Indian spirituality by these amazing musicians who were really doing things new and exciting is just really fun.
definitely worth mentioning. Let me ask just one sort of broad, maybe more creative question that requires you to extrapolate. What do you see as sort of the current knots to be entangled in the modern yoga movement? I think you preempt them and maybe allude to this in your book, but what do you see as sort of, I don't know how to put it, maybe knots to be entangled or rites of passage, or what do you see as sort of needing to happen in terms of yoga in the West and how we relate to it?
Okay, so this is going a bit away from my yoga in Britain research, but I think that the most crucial social issue at the moment is about consent and how we relate to authority figures. And there's nothing new in this Me Too in yoga movement that we've seen in the last few years. All these, because I also come from a perspective of sociology, religion, and new religious movements, and all these gurus in the 60s and 70s had the same kind of scandals, the complaints about perhaps Iyengar being too violent in his approach. There's nothing new about that. Those were always there. But what is different now is how we choose to interact and to see what we might not be comfortable with as a person, and that consent to discipline is something that is an ongoing negotiation. And you get a certain amount of freedom by submitting your ego, submitting your body to a practice or to a teacher. And there's nothing unique in yoga about this. This is something that any athlete undergoes to some extent. But I think sometimes there's an idealization of spiritual teachers as whatever they do must be right. And I hope as a society we're becoming a bit more critical, and both people who teach traditions that they want to present as spiritual and ethical, and people who want to be disciplined in a spiritual and ethical framework, both of those sides of the coin need to be much more proactive in identifying what they feel they can consent to sooner, and having an open discussion about things they feel uncomfortable with at a much sooner point. This is also the case with all sorts of relationships and power structures in our society at the moment.
Oh, that's an important and fascinating connection to research. I think it's a great place to end, to give folks something to think about. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time, and thank you for this really interesting work you're doing. I'd love to have you back on the program once you've done your collected volume, sort of broadening out and looking at yoga in other modern Western contexts. If you're up for it, we can chat again when that's out.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
Are you? Yeah. Are we kind of off record now, or?
We will be in a moment. Just stay tuned. For those of you listening, until next time, keep reading.